Greetings and salutations to everyone. This is AC2GS, otherwise known as Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limar Technical Center. That's been going on since 1982, Sunday nights at 8 p.m. And so it continues at 8 p.m. to hopefully about 11 p.m. Let's drop and I'll give you the usual links and such that you should be aware of.
Hey, Roy, you got some really bad static on your line there.
Okay, I have static on the line. That's odd. Let me try something. Okay, how's it now?
Still getting a lot of break up there.
Okay, I'm trying full power. How's this?
You got it now. Can you do AMZ?
Okay, well, we more power than I thought would be necessary, but so be it. Anyway, as always, if you have any questions that you can't reach us on the radio, or topics you would like to hear covered, or if you have any puzzles, or if you'd like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a space story, the email address to reach us is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links will be available either to topics that are discussed during this technical net or a few links that I find interesting and I want to share with people. There is a very interesting description of magnetic fields that's well done that I've listed in YouTube. And in addition, YouTube review of a new variation of the Nano VNA that I just recently purchased and haven't had a time chance to play around with yet. But that should be interesting. So that's available on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. Again, the link page is, you just type into the browser, roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, we have a chat room available if you want to chat it up. You can either go through Limar's website and find the link to the chat room, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you right to the chat room. And as always, I stream this on the Internet. Just point your browser to technet.ac2gs.com, and it'll show up with the audio stream. I want to remind everyone that MyKC2NJI has a wonderful archive site that has these technical nets that go all the way back to 2006 in September. And you can get any of them by just going over to his website, amateurradio.tv. And there's a lot of excellent, excellent information from some very, very smart hams who have unfortunately become silent keys over the years. Okay, let me drop, and then I'll give you our little schedule for tonight. Okay, unfortunately, we will not have an edition of Andy's Corner tonight, so we're going to go straight into questions of a technical nature, and I'll ask people to give me their name and their call sign, and first up, get the first chance to ask the question or raise the topic. If we run out of all those, I'll ask for just general science topics, or if someone wants to discuss the coronavirus situation, I'll try as best that I can. And if we have any other spare time before Paul's space report, which should begin around 10:15, I have a series of interesting science news articles that I'll tell you about and answer questions about as best that I can. With that in mind, I also want to mention to Lou, NY2H, if he's around, the Selden IRLP doesn't seem to be linked yet, so maybe it needs to be rebooted. Anyway, I'll drop for a second and let the game begin. Okay, once again, this is the Limar Technical Net. And if you have any questions or topics or comments that you'd like to make tonight, please give me your first name, your call sign, and whether you got a question or a comment.
This is KD2VCQ. My first name is George. and I have a question about NVIS, and I'm wondering, what is the best antenna and frequency to use for SkyWave communication?
Okay, George, I've heard you discussing this in the past. I think you were talking to Ed, WP2EAV. So you're top on the list tonight. Anyone else with any questions or topics that want to be put on the list? Okay, hopefully people will show up a little bit later. But George, were you talking to Ed earlier a couple days ago?
Well, that's me. I've heard your name several times. It's really nice to meet you finally.
Likewise, George. I understand that you're very interested in local communication, which is the whole point of near-vertical incident SkyWave. Basically, what it amounts to is you are manipulating an antenna such that its radiation is less horizontal to kind of skip across the ionosphere and more upwardly located to just right bounce right off whatever is up there back down locally. So that's near vertical incident SkyWave. Now, there are a lot of different ways of changing the radiation pattern. Most people want it the other way around. They want to have a nice low takeoff angle so that they can skip the ionosphere. I have a 10-meter 5/8 wave, and one of its supposedly good features is that its takeoff angle is even a little bit lower than a standard quarter-wave vertical. So, yours is not unusual. It's more related to emergency preparation type of people than amateurs who are into DXing. So there are many different antenna designs, but there's also different frequencies. Is there any particular frequency that you're looking for near-vertical incident SkyWave communication?
Pretty much open. I'm very new to this, but from what I've read, the military recommends anything under 8 megahertz.
Okay. I mean, in point of fact, the whole point for the most part of UHF and VHF is that it's all kind of local point-to-point transmission. So if you can get a antenna up as high as humanly possible, you're not going to get, with the exception of very odd E-layer propagation, you're going to get pretty much local communication. So if you're really looking for a local communication, I would think that your best bet would be the shorter wavelength, the UHF and VHF, and the high antenna, so that you're able to not be blocked by anything. Now, if you want to go lower frequency, it's possible. It's not quite as easy, and your limitations increase because of the mechanical length of the radiating antennas. If you just take a standard dipole, which almost everyone tries at one point or another, and you put it relatively low to the ground, I'm talking about within about a half of a wavelength, what you'll get is an interesting situation where rather than the normal radiation pattern that a dipole gives you, sort of a donut-shaped thing with a little bit more gain on at the right angle to the axis of the dipole, you'll actually get a lot of reflection, and it'll end up being a near-vertical incident SkyWave. So a poorly positioned standard half-wave dipole can be an excellent near-vertical incident SkyWave if it's not too high off of the ground.
Pretty interesting, Roy, because I have a note here to ask about a horizontal half-wave dipole. What's the difference between a half-wave antenna and a full-wave antenna? Is the amount of power transmission?
No. In order to be a very simple radiating antenna, has to be resonant. The way that antennas dipoles work is something called a standing wave. So what you want is a resonance taking place on the elements of the antenna. That happens at at odd intervals of one half of a wavelength. So you want the total dipole to be a half of a wavelength. You want each leg to be a quarter of a wavelength. By putting the feed in the center position, you decrease the input impedance down to approximately 50 ohms, which is what your transmitter likes to operate into. And so that's a half-wave dipole. A full-wave dipole is a different creature entirely. It has a very high impedance. You have to have impedance-matching circuits. And if most people don't have dipoles that are full-wave, unless they're trying to be multi-band and they're getting around things by playing with impedance transformers and such.
Okay, I understand that. Now, one of the I don't know how much you've heard about me or you know about me, but I'm in a homeowners association. I live in a co-op, so I have severe limitations or opportunities, depending on how you want to look at that. But I did measure my deck is 5 feet by 16 feet. And it's 8 feet above my head, with open 2x12 beams that are available, that are visible to me. And what I was thinking of doing was putting either a half wave 40 meter or a half wave 20 meter dipole up into the beams, using the wood of the beam as the insulator, and using crimp on eye caps. You know, like you put an end cap, a crimp on a wire to put on a bolt. I was thinking of using them as the end caps and screwing them into the wood, and using the wood as a my insulator, running one leg right on the deck, you know, from the center of the front span of the deck, from the center of the 16-foot span, run one 8 feet to the right and run the driven elements to the right and to the left from the center of that front 12-inch beam, and then get out to the end and turn them back toward the house. I've read that as long as you turn, you can bend the dipole 90 degrees, but toward the end of the radiating elements. Then also I've been studying, secondarily to that, if you take a reflecting wire and put it 0.15 under the main elements, you create what's called a cloud warmer, as long as it's like 5% more than the radiating elements. A question is, I think I've seen the diagrams of the dipole you were describing later before. By lowering the element close to the ground, you get this big, like, round circle. You change the entire radiating pattern into a big vertical, almost like an oblong, whereas if you come closer to the ground, you start catching reflection, and you get two secondary lobes kind of radiating out on 45-degree angles opposite the vertical pole. So I'm just one of the other questions I had is if I add a second or a third, if I add two more reflectors at perhaps 160 and 200 degrees to the vertical underneath the main elements, would that help focus the vertical beam even tighter?
The law to connect off.
Okay. Well, you threw out a lot of things. When you're playing with slightly larger parasitic elements that you mentioned, that's a reflector. Basically, you're kind of mimicking the effects of a very simple Yagi. Yagis are designed with parasitic elements, shorter ones in front of the driven element, and a single reflector behind it that's a little longer. Usually, one reflector is as good as two reflectors. They don't really add up too much. You can get more directionality from a Yagi if you increase the number of directors, the shorter parasitic elements in the front. So I don't think multiple reflectors would really benefit you that much. My one big question is, and, you know, I mean, different bands work differently at different times of the day and seasons and different aspects of sunspot cycle. And I was listening a little bit to you and Ed discussing 10 meters. And 10 meters is a favorite of mine. I also am net control operator frequently for the Kings County Radio Club 10 meter net Sunday mornings. And so I have a little bit of experience on 10 meters. 10 meters right now is sort of, it was pretty much dead. because it was the sunspot minimum. But as the sunspot activity is getting along, it's going to open up, and you'll get a lot of distance on 10 meters. 20 meters is kind of neither fish nor fowl, at least for me. If you catch it during the early to mid-daytime, it's somewhat decent. And as it gets to be about 4 o'clock or even 3 o'clock, it goes dead. 40, for me, is the most consistently active band there is. It's not terribly active during high noon, but for most of the later day and the night, it's nice and active. 80 is pretty much active at night. But a lot of these things are active in the distances. They're not really great for local communication. You get some ground wave propagation, and I guess you can use near vertical incident sky waves. But again, if your bottom line is you want to talk to people locally, you might want to consider, non-militarily, the higher UV and UHF and VHF frequencies, because that's where a lot of people are listening locally. If you go to 40, they kind of tend to be looking for distant conversation.
I can understand that as a generality. It's actually funny that you mentioned the 40 meter, because all the math that I've been doing, trying to figure out lengths and, where I could put this thing, is based on the 40 meter frequency, a wavelength. I hear what you're saying. I'm thinking a couple different things. Number one, for NVIS, I'm thinking I want a communication available to me that's dependable and repeatable, that I can talk to people in the event of a net.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Active. As far as like 2 meter or 70 centimeter, I understand through the repeaters. Now, I understand the Brookhaven, the BNL repeater, has like a really super, like a power backup system, where it'll just basically, as long as the Earth is still here and there hasn't been, nuclear annihilation, that BNL repeater is going to be up forever. I'm not sure how that is with other local area repeaters. I understand simplex operation, and I've actually done a few experiments with some local people trying to establish simplex communication, but my relative newness to this, I'm not really sure. I have a brand new radio. I'm not really sure how to manipulate it, even as a novice, forget expertly. But I do notice a lot of times when I'm keying my mic, I notice the offset on the transmission frequency change. So I'm trying to figure out how to negate that. I know there's an offset setting somewhere in here, but that's kind of low on my priority list right now for learning.
Okay, I mean, it's always good to read the manual. Most people don't. As far as you're saying offset, I assume you mean the transmission frequency offset. For VHF repeaters, the standard is 600 kilocycle split. Some people historically have a 1 megacycle split. But in addition to repeaters, as you said, repeaters are available, but they're iffy. Some are bulletproof, and others are far from it. They don't even have emergency power, and some of them break at times. The simplex operation that you mentioned. Also, in addition, you can consider the possibility of getting yourself a small Yagi, and by either with a rotator, or it doesn't have to be a rotator, if it's sitting on your patio or whatever, you can point it in different directions and get a decent gain, and you can increase the directionality and the range for individual other uses. There's a community of people who operate single sideband with a horizontally polarized antenna element. So that's another option. A lot of these people, though, are pretty much locked into being local anyway. So you're more likely to get more ears listening locally than you probably would if you go 40, where, although it's active over a large area. So you have to figure out that locally, it's not quite that active, unfortunately.
Then that makes a lot of sense. And I am interested. I mean, I'm not interested in emergency services 400 miles away. In the event of an emergency, I want to be able to talk to somebody down the street that can bring resources to an emergency. In talking with Ed, who is absolutely fantastic, I was kind of in my initial ignorance of everything, staying away from digital because I always assumed you were using your computer to communicate to connect to the internet, which is not the case. I understand that like a Whisper or a Pactor systems, they put out such a small packet of data that you could use minimal, minuscule bandwidth, and then at that point, you could actually transmit large distances with very low energy. That being said, I am very interested in local, dependable, repeatable communications in the event of an emergency in a grid-down or a net-down situation. This is KD2VCQ.
And this is AC2GS. Well, digital comes in all kinds of flavors. You know, the older variety, the Pactor and the Wincom, usually is text-based. It transmits basically email, and because it has a low symbol rate, it's a little bit less sensitive to background noise. The other digital mode that most people are interested in are the voice digital mode, the DMR and the D-Star and the Fusion that we talk about. Most of those are unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever, based on repeaters, either repeaters or internet protocol access through networks. There's a little bit of a point-to-point communication using those digital technologies, but they're more the exception to the rule. So although people find it fascinating to use DMR especially, and this club has DMR repeaters and such, you are kind of locked into a repeater at the very least, and if you're interested in using their talk group, the talk groups operate through internet protocol, so you have to have an access line for the internet for that to work.
That kind of answers that question. Let me just step off from you here. I feel like I'm hogging this discussion. I don't want to step on anybody else. So I'm going to stop for a few minutes and keep quiet.
Okay, well, like I said, there was only one person asking questions at the top of the hour, and that was you. But I will throw it out to the audience if they have any particular likes or dislikes, whether they have other experiences that they'd like to share, or any comments about near vertical incident sky wave operation. Okay, appears that no one has any opinions one way or the other. I'll give it one more chance. And I'm wondering, Chris is in the chat room. I don't know if Chris is able to get into the repeater today. He asked a question about the difference between a half wave and a full wave and its power handling. Oh, okay. Unfortunately, Chris can't get into the radio right now. Once again, if anyone has their own opinion about near vertical incident sky wave or the best band to do NVIS, please hit that push to talk button. Well, George, it seems to be just me and you on this subject.
Baker 2 Alpha Hotel Kilo.
The radiation pattern we covered, cloud warmers we talked about. More than one reflector we talked about, halfway dipole, same as the difference. One quick question. I've read a couple articles. It seems like there's absolutely no problem painting a fiberglass antenna, and that pretty much has to do with me, again, living in the co-op. I actually bought a spray paint that's the same color of the walls of the co-op buildings in an attempt to possibly camouflage my antenna. So I was reading about painting fiberglass antennas, and almost every article I've read says there's absolutely no problem and it doesn't affect the propagation in any way whatsoever. I don't know if you have any experience with that.
We'll get to that in 1 second. I believe Chester WA2AHK wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, hi, Roy and everybody. I was just thinking that right now, best band for hams for local communications would be 10 meters right now, because it gives you a little more distance, you can go to nearby states. And then 220 is a very good local band, 220, and then Phoebus. Those three bands would be the best for local communications.
Okay, very good, the suggestions. Like I said, I'm a regular on 10 meters. You get usually, for some odd reason, I have noticed in Brooklyn that there seems to be some kind of a border between Queens and the Nassau County line. We usually get people in Queens and Brooklyn, Staten Island, parts of New Jersey. We don't get people in Nassau, and we never get people in Suffolk. I don't know why that is. We don't get people up north. Sometimes when things open up a little bit, and this is all in the sunspot minimum time, we get the southeast corridor. We get the coastal states going down south all the way to Florida. I talked to two guys from Florida this morning on 10 meters. 10 meters is okay, but it sort of depends upon ground limitations, hilly lands and such. Large buildings will block the 10-meter signal. Again, I think if you're really interested in local communications in this day and age, it's really, as Chet mentioned, 220 is okay. 220 is a fine frequency. It's just kind of isolated. There's very few people on it. Not to say that there's no one on it, because I don't want to upset anyone. But there's far less people on 220 than there is on VHF, and to a degree, I think UHF is one of the more active. Although that can be a kind of a false thing. If you ever look at a pan adapter on UHF, you see a lot of activity. But if you actually tune in, you'll kind of find that there's about five different, at least in this area, five different DMR stations that are all broadcasting the same talk group. So although they're active with the same darn thing. Let me see if I have this. Okay. Getting back to your other question, actually, you realize that fiberglass antennas is just the covering of the antenna. The antenna itself is a conducting metal inside the covering. As long as it's not some very esoteric paint that is metallic in origin, painting your fiberglass covered antenna to camouflage it is fine. Sometimes you have to be very, very tricky. There are some colors that seem that they'll blend in that don't. Most of the time I find that as long as it's very thin, no one notices. I was very surprised when I first mocked up my antenna system in my backyard. It upset a lot of people, but once I hoisted it to the roof, I haven't heard anyone complain. No one looks up.
That makes a lot of sense. I understand, you know, as a hunter, being in a tree stand gives you a lot of advantages. Couple other questions that reminded me of. Now, you know, mentioning Kenwave, in talking to Ed had initially scared me off the 10-meter, and then I saw your transmission, your email regarding 10-meter propagation, how it's coming back as the activity level moves toward maximal over the next 5 or 6 years, which was encouraging. So I'm also concentrating on information around 10 meters. Two questions, I should ask them in a separate statement. Being as I have my deck and I have that vertical space in between the 12-inch beams, if I put a 10-meter and a 40-meter half-wave dipole or 20-meter dipole in the same space and only use one antenna at a time, would the other elements, even though there's no power on them, incidentally act as a reflector, as like in a cloud warmer antenna?
Most likely no. What you're sort of describing is a partially disconnected fan dipole. My dipole right now is called a fan dipole. It is a single feed, a coaxial cable goes up to a feed point That feed point has four separate pieces of wire in parallel. One is the resonant length of a half-wave 10-meter dipole. The other has a 20. The other has a 40. And there's a extra inductor that lengthens it to 80 meter resonance. So you can actually parallel different dipoles and have them coexist reasonably well. The beauty of a fan dipole is that it will go to the resonant leg because the resonant leg will have the lowest resistance or actually impedance. So if you send, say, a 20 megahertz transmission up to a fan dipole with multiple elements, only the 20 meter resonant leg is going to see it as a 50 ohm impedance. The others will see it as 1,000 ohms or 2,000 ohms, and so the current won't flow there. So it kind of auto-regulates itself. It's a very interesting design.
Just had an aha moment. I understand. It'll follow the path of least resistance automatically without me doing a thing, without a switcher or anything else. I think I just had in a lightning bolt moment what Ed was telling me when I keep pushing him in the direction of horizontal bipole, near vertical skywave, cloud burner antennas, and he's telling me you don't want to go down that rabbit hole because you need to learn some basics first. And in listening to your description, I think I understand what he was talking about at this point. I need a lot more fundamental knowledge, which brings me to you were mentioning multiple feed points. That's actually one question I had. Is there an advantage or disadvantage to having multiple feed points on an antenna?
Well, usually you don't have simultaneous multiple feed points. You can place a feed point any place on a radiating antenna. Most times people will do a standard dipole in which they will center feed it with a nominal, in free space it comes out to about 73 ohms of impedance. When you put it close to earth it drops down to about 50. As you slide it right or left, the impedance will go higher and higher and higher, and you'll have to have some impedance matching in order for your transmitter to deal with it without complaining and getting reflections and such. So you can place a center feed, you can place a antenna feed any point on the line as long as you are willing to deal with how that modifies the characteristics of an antenna. Now, that's just for a dipole. There are other antennas in which a cubic antenna, if you you can have two different antenna feeds at right angles to each other, and by switching between the two antenna feeds, you can have it either be a horizontally polarized transmitter antenna versus a vertical. So that's another way that one antenna can have more than one feed point, but you don't want to really feed them simultaneously. I mean, there are other esoteric things in which you can clamp together different radiating antennas, and as long as you keep them in sync, you can benefit from a 3 decibel gain. You take two regular Yagis, you make sure that the distance between the two is correct for that wavelength, and you effectively have a 3 decibel increase in the radiated energy going out there. But that's a different thing. That's two antennas with one single feed point. So there's all kinds of complications and permutations.
KD2VCQ. Okay, I understand exactly what you're saying. I'm actually looking at diagrams of a fan antenna, a fan dipole antenna right now. It looks like all the feeds are either coming out of a common element where there's separate feed points on like a plate. Is there any requirement between the radiated, the elements, the driven elements? I see them fanning out from horizontal to downward bending. And is there any requirement for spacing between the elements, like a minimum spacing requirement?
There's no standard one. Usually the most fan dipoles I've seen started about an inch separation, but you could separate it 3 inches, 5 inches, 10 inches. I wouldn't put it, 0.1 inch away from each other, but probably, the only problem I could see is where you might have some kind of electrical breakdown, going there if the voltage potentials are very high. But that's not a real big concern. You need to have a constant, at best, separation between the elements and an understanding that although you could look up the book and see the magic way of calculating a half-wave dipole is using the magic number 468, you have to kind of tweak and tune a fan dipole because there'll be a little bit of a coupling between each of the elements that will shift its resonance a little bit. So be prepared to kind of shorten it, put it up somewhere relatively similar to where you want it, run some power through it, and take a good antenna analyzer and tweak the lens.
I got that. Leads me to one other question, talking about dipole antennas and radiating elements. I was thinking, with limited space, how to get more antenna element into space. Is there anything? I can't really find anything about. I see small coil antennas as, I guess, like a space requirement. When you have a strict space requirement, small coil antennas. I was wondering, what would be the effect, good or bad, if you took a dipole element and coiled it like a spring to actually use the same amount of material in a much shorter space? How would that affect the radiating envelope?
Well, most likely it would affect it significantly. You would have a lot of both inductive and capacitive coupling of the radiating elements, so the values would be different, the impedances would be different. It would probably be very frequency sensitive, which is why pretty much no one does that. There are these very novel designs. One is called a compact antenna. You can look that up as well. It's not exactly what you described. It sort of would be if you, instead of had a dipole, had a quarter wave a vertical, and somehow out of some metal that you could flatten, and then you flattened it very thin, and then you coiled it around. So that's sort of what a compact antenna is. It's a very unique design. The designer has some interesting theories of how it works that make no particular sense to me or a lot of people who've been in this hobby much longer than me. But take a look at it. It is a compact design, and apparently some of their antennas are rated for rather significant bandwidth. Keep in mind, though, that just because something is tunable doesn't mean that it's a good antenna, because in addition to being able to tune to 50 ohms, you also have to concern yourself with the radiation pattern that we mentioned before, the takeoff angle, and the efficiency of an antenna. There are some ham sticks that are used in mobile, in cars, that will tune to 80 meters or even 160 meters. If you look at the amount of output that the antenna gives up, it's 1% efficient, which is not terribly good.
I understand that. So we've talked about all of the questions that I've had in my short experience with radio, and I certainly appreciate that. I have a much better understanding than I did when the call started. I'm going to ask probably the most important question I've asked at this point. Knowing me, knowing me as you know me at this point, being new, if you could only give me one piece of advice or tell me one thing, what would that be?
Ask a lot of people a lot of questions. And as a corollary to that, it's always good to calibrate what I call the BS meter. There are some brilliant guys out there, Ed is a very smart guy. There's a lot of smart guys out there. There's a lot of guys with a lot of experience and willing to share their knowledge. Occasionally, unfortunately, you might find some guy who's a little bit more verbose without particularly knowing what he's talking about. So ask a lot of questions, because 99% of the guys and ladies out there are more than happy to help you with this. But to calibrate that BS meter.
Thank you for that. Excuse me, that reminds me of another question I have. What is a good book out there that I can get or acquire to read about antenna theory?
Start with the ARRL handbook.
Ed, that's a very good idea. The handbook is probably one of the first books that I read in high school. Fortunately, I think, I'm not quite sure if I got it out of the library, or I know I bought one, a copy myself, and I read through it. That's a given. It's a bargain for the money. ARRL books tend to be kind of not a lot of pages and rather expensive per page, but both the antenna handbook and the regular ARRL handbook are great values. And in addition, the ARRL has a new book on antenna theory. It's thinner. It doesn't go into the specifics of different models like the antenna handbook does, but it goes into theory. And, you know, at first I thought it was going to be, you know, my friend the antenna kind of grammar school stuff. But they actually go into some esoteric aspects without giving you a migraine. It never, under any circumstances, pick up a college textbook for electrical engineers on antenna theory. It will give you a nosebleed. It uses a lot of heavy-duty mathematics that will not be helpful for most people.
KD2BCQ. Roy, quick question. If I'm going to be interested in it, I seem to be drawn to antennas. I can't get away from it. I'm particularly drawn. Aside from a field strength meter, what other diagnostic or analysis instruments or tools should I have handy?
Basically, a VNA, the Vector Network Analyzer. Now, fortunately, 3 years ago, a VNA would set you back about $30,000 and be about 50 pounds. But like I said, if you go to roy.ac2gs.com, there's a YouTube video of a review for a relatively inexpensive VNA that I just purchased. It's a nano VNA. I got the one with the big screen. You can get a less expensive one that has a 2.5-inch vertical diagonal screen. Mine was 4 inches. That cost $80 instead of $50. But although it's probably not as good as a $1,000 VNA, it goes from something like 50 kilohertz to 3 gigahertz. And you can plug it into your computer as well. VNA is a very good thing to have. It's called an antenna analyzer.
CD2TRG with a comment, Roy?
Yes, TRG.
I was talking with George last night for a little while, KD2VCO. Really concur with that nano VNA. I picked one up, I guess, maybe like 6 months ago, and I actually took it into work and I compared it with my HP, my 85, I think it's the 8564, one of my network analyzers. And depending on how well you calibrate that VNA, it was actually surprisingly accurate, $60,000 network analyzer. So, that's like you said, for $70-$80, you can't go wrong. And even if you buy the cheap, small one, you can hook it up to your iPad or your tablet, and you can get the larger screen, and you can do everything right on there. It's definitely the best bang for the buck. I totally concur.
Very good. Yeah, I've seen YouTubes where they try to tune a duplexer, and apparently because the dynamic range isn't quite up to snuff, it's not terribly good for that. But, I mean, none of us really tune duplexes. The thing that I like about this particular model that I purchased, I am not an incredibly big fan of SMA connectors. I find them way too fiddly. This particular version of the NanoVNA, instead of the SMA connectors, have N connectors, which are incredibly more sturdy.
Kilo 2 Lima Lima Echo. Got a question about the NanoVNA. How does that compare with Rig Expert?
Well, I have both. I like my Rig Expert. It's a fine machine. The problem is that in order to get anywhere close to the range that the NanoVNA gives you, it costs an order of magnitude more. You know, if you're just interested in one of the less expensive Rig Experts, then it certainly is more user-friendly. It has a nice big touchpad. It has, a carry case and such. So it's nice. Like I said, I have it. I guess I'm addicted to getting VNAs. I have an Array Solutions AIM 4300. I have a Rig Expert AA 600. And now I have this little NanoVNA. You know, there's nothing wrong with any of them per se. It's just getting something like this in an $80 package that has such a wide range in frequencies just strikes me as a win-win.
GXM?
Yes, GXM.
AC2GS in the group, WB2GXM. I think I've asked this question before, but what is the best source to get the NanoVNA, the larger screen that you bought?
Well, the standard explanation is to seek out forums, ask other people their experiences, and mimic them. Being a, not that organized sometimes, I went to Alibaba and looked for something with the specs that I really, really wanted, because I couldn't find anyone reselling this particular version with N connectors other than in Alibaba.
Alibaba for me. I will go there. WB2GXM.
C2 Bravo Zoom.
Yes, Rich.
The gentleman before, I didn't get the call, said that he brought the VNA into work, and if you calibrate it, it came very close to his commercial version. What do you mean by calibrate? Go ahead.
VNAs are designed, for the most part, requiring calibration using three test values. This takes the connector and any extender cable that you're plugging into the test device out of the equation. The three test connectors, one is an open circuit connector, one is a short connector circuit, and one is a 50-ohm connector circuit. So basically what you do is, under most circumstances, you turn the VNA on, you press the little calibrate button, which is somewhere, and it says, okay, give me how it's programmed. It says, give me the open load. And you do that, and it tests it, and it says, give me the short load. And you do that, and it says, give me the 50-ohm load. And you do that. And as long as it's on and using the same connectors and the same cables and such, going into the test equipment, it's calibrated. If you change any of the variables, it's always good to recalibrate. Yes, Wesley.
It is an interesting subject. Actually, I would like to add something to it. Let's say you have number of connectors. So let's say you don't have the N connector, you have the SMA, or you have any kind of connector in the VNA. And you connected a connector from SMA to N connector. And then you connected 30 feet or 40 feet, 100 feet of flexure cable, 50 ohm. And then, at the end of it, you want to make sure that you're measuring your antenna, whatever you want. You can measure any load. Let's say you're not sure that your 50 ohm termination connector, which would be the resistor, equivalent to the impedance of the antenna is good. Let's jump. In the set of nano DNA or any other one, you should have open, short, and 50 ohm. Those are calibration resistors. If you don't have them, you can buy the set. And then, with all of that connected, you just put your short, your open, and your 50 ohm, and you calibrate it. Now, what is happening is, your VNA doesn't see all of those connections, all of those cables. It's as they don't exist at all. You don't have to climb on the ladder. You're just sitting in your chair, next to your rig. And now, you could analyze the antenna, or you can analyze that load that is at the end of it. Because now, after this calibration, you're just putting that what you want to measure. If you remember correctly, there was a time when Dick was saying, well, 50 ohm is a compromise. It's actually 32 ohm or 38 ohm, good for the transmitting, and whatever the impedance is good for the receiver. But we happen to choose something that is not so bad and not so good for either application. We want to have a receiving and transmitting. And we decided that we want to have a 50 ohm. That was the standard that is present in every other device. But now, if we go to something like the what DNA do I should buy? It is a very interesting question because I have HP 8753D. That is from 30 kilohertz to 6 gigahertz. It's a big device, but it gives me all of the coverage from 30 kilohertz to 6 gigahertz. Now, I spent some money. Now I have, in the comfort of my place where I'm sitting when I have my rig, I have everything that I want with one single tool. And I have insertion loss, and I have a VSWR, and I have all of the measurements. I have a Smith chart. I have... I should look at the menu, but actually everything is possible. Now, some other guys say, "Hey, I'm mostly a HF guy. I'm not really a VHF or UHF guy, but I want to have really something good." Now, I have another one, which would be R3754B. R3754B. That's advanced. Vector network analyzer. And this one goes from 10 kilohertz to 150 megahertz. So now with that, I have all of the HF bands. And I have a 144 megahertz, which would be the 2 meter band. Now, because of the limitation, some of them you can buy for pennies, for just a small amount of money. So if you think about buying a shiny nano DNA for $80 or $100, when you pay the shipping, when you pay the taxes over it, it's going to come up to $250. Now, there are some options on eBay that you can buy a state-of-the-art DNA. They are multi big one, and they are old one. But they have a good display, and mostly monochromatic. They don't likely have a color, but there are some of them that are there in color. And you can do it. Now, another way of doing it, forget about the VNA. Forget about, just get to a signal analyzer. And those signalizers, they look like VNA, they look like a spectrum analyzer, but they are not. They are actually more deep and more directed to the antenna. So, there are many of choices. Back to you, and to HVS.
AC2GX. Yes, you're right, Wesley, that there are a lot of different choices, and I mentioned as well that by calibrating it, you take the extraneous stuff out of the equation and you're testing the device that you want to test. You know, shipping and taxes is not really a problem with buying Chinese things because in the end, they're subsidized. I think basically they charged me about $3-4 for shipping, which probably if we ship something to China would cost $25. And then on top of that, they gave me a discount of $5 just because I hadn't used their services lately. So 6 to 1, half a dozen. They're very inexpensive. If you want to buy a big, heavy, used thing that hopefully is still in calibration, that's certainly an option. What I also didn't mention to the to someone who I think it was Rich WB2GXM. I'm not sure. With the Rig Expert, Rig Expert is only one port. So although one port serves my purposes, my my AIM array solutions is also a single port VNA. The Nano VNA is a dual port, so you could actually do more esoteric testing if that's what you want to do with it. So it even has that feature.
WA2MAB.
Yes, MAB.
Yes, the Nano VNA. Could you export the S2C file?
I do not know because I haven't tinkered with it yet. It is able to be connected to the computer, and I believe it also has an interface to work with the tablets and such. So it might be possible. I just haven't really dived deeply into what you can do with it. There are multiple forums on the internet of people who love this design and talk about it incessantly. And just touching back on what Wesley mentioned, there's another product that was mentioned in the TechNet before called TinySA, Tiny Spectrum Analyzer, which is a kind of a similar designed by some guy, mass-produced in China for peanuts, that I ordered. The only downside for buying it directly in China is that you have to be very patient because it could take as much as 2 months to get the darn thing. There are, in some cases, American importers who will import it and then hike the price up, you know, $30-40. But if you're patient, you don't really need it as a tool for tomorrow. It's a cost-effective measure. China subsidizes all this for some nefarious reason, no doubt.
Okay, there's my line on that. Yeah, there's plenty of YouTube videos on SW2AEW. The other problem with the older VNAs is you can't export the data. If they have floppies, a lot of times the floppies don't work, but have the proprietary interface to a disk drive, and you really want to be able to get those files so you can bring them into like Octave or even import them into Excel and do analysis on the measurements.
Yeah, I heard that there are some differences. Again, I wish I had more free time to putter about with it. I just kind of opened it up, turned it on, make sure that it was functioning, and then put it back in its case until I have some time to really figure it out. I downloaded some software. It's not the most polished software because users just kind of threw it together. There's apparently a decent Python written program that runs it through PCs. So it's you know, I'm in the midst of trying to figure it out. You know, it's a complicated device. It has many features, so it has a lot to learn. Or I have a lot to learn about it.
That's fine. Yeah, that's, yeah, I was thinking of getting one of them also. Especially that model you said with the end connectors looked pretty good. But we'll, right now, I'm actually wanted to ask the question if anybody's interested in how
it's sort of off the subject. Anybody interested in how signals are synthesized, like the FDA signals, the 4FM? I'm working up some signal models in octaves. If anybody is interested in the subject, I know it's off the network analog, WA2MAC.
Well, I'll ask if anyone has any further comments on this subject, and then we could hear what you're working on.